CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
This program reflects the views and opinions of the participants and not necessarily those of CFUV. Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 5th, 2022. Well, though it's not said in so many words, Canada is at war. Years of Canadian military support for the coup government and its successors in Ukraine has bolstered efforts to bring to heel the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Lugansk. Up until a couple of weeks ago, that one-sided backing of Kiev in its civil war was officially limited to non-lethal aid and providing military training. But that all changed on St. Valentine's Day. Then, as the Trudeau government's unprecedented enactment of the Emergencies Act was declared, a small announcement outlining the lethal change of policy, allowing machine guns, pistols, carbines, and ammunition be shipped by Canadian companies into Ukraine, was slipped quietly past the Ottawa Press Gallery. Ken Stone is a longtime anti-war activist who's served as an executive member of both the Syria Solidarity Movement and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Ken and the Coalition have released a statement on the situation in Ukraine. Ukraine, the U.S., and NATO created this mess. Ken Stone in the first half. And the last 2 years has proven a challenge to all of us as individuals. The degree of that challenge has varied for all the usual reasons. Life is more difficult for some than others, and for some new reasons too. Andy Lee Roth is the Associate Director of Project Censored and coordinates the project's Campus Affiliates program. His writing and research are published across the internet and in a variety of print publications. He's co-edited a dozen editions of Project Censored yearbooks, including the 2022 version, State of the Free Press 2022, that's now out and available from Seven Stories Press. Andy Lee Roth and Assessing the State of the Free Press in the second half. But first, Ken Stone and Canada marching into another war of empire. Welcome back to the program, Ken.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure. You know that. Well, Ken, the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War's release strikes a different tone than that championed by virtually all media in this country and across the NATO sphere. Should we, Ken, not be condemning Russia's so-called military technical operation in Ukraine, too?
No, we shouldn't, Chris, because it's the U.S. and NATO that created this mess. They have set it up for 30 years. And it was amazing to me that it took 30 years for the Russians to respond. But they were put in a situation, an existential crisis, if you like, in which they had to respond because NATO in 1990, the leaders of NATO, the leaders of the U.S., they made a promise to Gorbachev that if he approved the reunification of Germany, they promised that NATO would not expand even one inch eastward of Germany. And over the 30 years that have passed since then, NATO has expanded 800 kilometers eastward and taken in 14 countries, some of them right up to the borders of the Russian Federation. They lied in 1990. They deliberately lied. And there's documentation to show that they put in writing the promise to Gorbachev. And what the game of the U.S. and NATO is to expand NATO right up to the borders of Russia and then to dismember Russia the way that they did the former Yugoslavia in the year 1999. Well, they started in 1990, but it took 10 years. And that's what they still intend to do to Russia. And I'm amazed that the Russians were so patient and so accommodating. They complained every inch of the way, but at a certain point, they were going to respond. And many, many Western commentators, including U.S. commentators like Professor John Mearsheimer. There's an article that is going around, very popular right now, which he predicted after the coup in Ukraine in 2014 that it was just a matter of time until Russia responded to the eastward expansion of NATO. So for 30 years, this has been the plan. It's a plan for U.S. hegemony over all of the European continent. It's a plan to dismember Russia and to Balkanize it the way they did the former Yugoslavia. But the plan became even more serious or more scary to the Russians in 2014 when the U.S. inspired a coup led by Victoria Nuland, and she boasted about how it cost her $5 billion, but she overthrew the democratically elected government of Yanukovych in Ukraine in the Maidan protests in 2014. And by the way, Canada supported those protests and supported the coup. Our foreign minister, John Baird, attended in the Maidan Square, and he was there to show Canada's support to the protesters. But it went beyond that, actually. The Canadian embassy was used as a refuge from police and government officials who were trying to put down protests. They hid in the Canadian embassy. They stayed there for a whole week. They used the Canadian vehicle to get around Kiev. And they a speaker for the Maidan coup was employed by the Canadian embassy. So the Canadian government is complicit with the coup. Well, what's important about this coup, you may ask? And what's important is that it put into power a pro-Western government. And unlike the neutral government that was trying to balance West and East under Yanukovych, and the government put into power also was riddled with explicitly neo-Nazi elements. And I don't mean just neo-fascist, I mean neo-Nazi. The descendants of the parties in the Ukraine in the early 1940s that supported and organized SS Brigade to fight with Adolf Hitler's Nazis against the Soviet Union. So that they put those people in power in the cabinet, and they allowed the Nazis to have a militia called the Azov Battalion, which later became part of the Ukrainian regular forces and became a division size almost. That's a lot of soldiers. And they were instrumental in starting a war against the Russian-speaking minority in the Donbass region. Now, the people in the Donbass had a form of autonomy, something like the special status of Quebec. Their language, Russian, was recognized as an official language in Ukraine, and they had many cultural institutions. The new junta that got into power in Ukraine removed the special status of the Donbass region. They took away Russian as an official language. They outlawed the parties that were based, the Russian-based parties, political parties from the Donbass region. And when the Donbass rose up in revolt, as would happen if a Canadian government did the same thing to Quebec, when the Donbass rose up in revolt, they proceeded to launch a war against it. And that war lasted 8 long years, from 2014 till now. And in that war, there was a lot of shelling, mostly from the Ukrainian side onto the Donbass republics. And about 14,000 people were killed, mostly in the Donbass. And about 1 million people were turned into homeless refugees, most of them in the Donbass. So the Russians were faced with a war against the Russian-speaking minority on their border. And in the last days of, I'm glad you noticed February 17th, because in the last weeks before the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the West increased their lethal aid to the Ukrainian junta, including Canada. I'm glad you mentioned that. And the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is the group that monitors these conflicts in Europe, noted that there was a huge increase in bombings and artillery shellings from the Ukrainian army into the Donbass region. And in the last day or so before the Russian military operation, Mr. Zelensky made statements which really set the hair of the Russians on fire, which was to say that he said that he wanted Ukraine to become part of NATO, and he would accept Western nuclear missiles to be placed on Ukrainian soil. Well, I think that was the final straw. On December 21st, 2021, the Russian government issued two draft statements, one to NATO, one to the U.S., outlining its, what I feel, were reasonable security demands. And it's based on the formula in international law called the indivisibility of security. In other words, the basic premise is you can't give security to one country at the expense of another. So the Russians' main argument, or their main demand, they had several demands, including that NATO roll back to its 1998 position. They were willing to accept that as a starting bargaining position. But one of their main demands was, and probably the main demand, was that Ukraine be demilitarized and that it become neutral, and that that the West give a ironclad guarantee that Ukraine would never become part of NATO. And the U.S. simply dismissed these demands out of hand. So when all these things rolled into place after February 17th, as you noted, the increasing lethal aid, a further attack on the Donbass region, which the Russians saw as an attempt to eliminate the Russian-speaking minority right out on their doorstep, and the statements by Zelensky just before February 24th that he wanted to join NATO and was willing to accept nuclear missiles, which would give the Russians no advance warning if they were sent off, if they were ever to be used. The Russians responded, and they decided to do this military operation inside Ukraine with two objectives. One was to demilitarize Ukraine, that is to say, to turn it into a neutral country without offensive weapons, and two, to denazify Ukraine, that is to say, to remove the Azov battalion and all the other Nazi fighters in the Ukrainian army and get them out of Ukraine. And they wanted to see, of course, that Ukraine turn into a neutral country. And that's what they proceeded to do. And there are people who do call that pin the blame on Russia, but I think they're short-sighted. They can't see, they don't make the junction between cause and effect. They don't see that 30 years of pushing the Russians into a corner, they don't see how it results in Russia striking back in its own reasonable self-interest. So in my books, Russia is not the enemy. In my books, the U.S. and NATO are the enemy. They are the ones that created this crisis, just as they have created crises and wars in the former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Iraq. They are a gang of thieves and land destroyers. And they, in this particular case, they had the vision to destroy Russia. And Russia just said, nah, we're not waiting till the last moment when NATO is right on our borders and we're weak and defenseless like Iraq in 2003 after 10 years of sanctions and 500,000 children having died from hunger and disease. They decided to strike back when the iron was hot. And the Russian-speaking people of the Donbass called on them to protect their lives and their national status. So that's that's how I look at it.
Well, and I've talked to John Helmer about this a number of times, and Russia has been issuing red lines and warnings that it was against the wall and that it wouldn't put up with it for almost a year now. On various occasions, the last, as you mentioned, just before Christmas. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ken Stone. Ken's a longtime anti-war activist who served as an executive member for both the Syria Solidarity Movement and Hamilton's Coalition to Stop the War. We're talking today about the coalition's recent release, Ukraine, the U.S. and NATO Created This Myth. Well, those in the anti-war movement, Ken, and you among them, it's one thing to say, well, it wasn't Russia's fault, but there's another thing that war is this instrument that they're using, and there's people being killed, innocent people that have nothing to do with any of all of this, people that would be sympathetic to the plight of those in the Donbass region as well. Just to pick up on what you were saying, though, about Canada's role, Eve Engler has written a lot about the issue that's going on right now. And I was going to talk with him last week and did, in fact, but technical matters got in the way. One of his articles about Canada's involvement in all this before the fact is the truth. Truth always the first casualty of war. CBC proves it. It's a scathing expose on Murray Brewster, one of their reporters, and not so much what he said, but what he failed to say, failed to reiterate some of his earlier reports on Canada's involvement. And you mentioned Canada's embassy providing shelter to the revolutionaries before the fact. And he used the analogy of Quebec, saying, imagine if the truckers' protest in Ottawa had been financed by Russia, the Russian embassy had been used to support those behind the movement, and that the movement had succeeded in overthrowing the government and installing a fascist, racist regime that hated French-speaking people and that outlawed French and that started attacking French-speaking people all over English Canada. Well, the people in Quebec might not like that so much and might separate as the people in the Donbass area had done. And then imagine if this new government in Canada started bombing Quebec. This is the situation that was playing out before Russia attacked. Now, Ken, that all said, though, what about the defense of those people caught under the bombs in Western Ukraine? If the idea of the Hamilton Coalition is to stop wars, how do we stop this war rather than saying, well, Russia is justified in doing what it's doing, when we could take the position that war isn't a justified response to the kind of pressures that you're outlining earlier?
I think this was a move in self-defense by the Russian Federation. While I have been active in the anti-war movement for 50 years, from Vietnam till today, and I don't like to see wars where people, innocent civilians, are killed, and there's a lot of damage to civilian infrastructure, and there's a lot of ecological damage. At the same time, I don't think that Russia had any choice. I think we have to understand that the people who are caught in the middle of this, who haven't been able to get out of the line of fire, in some cases, and for example, in Mariupol, where the Azov Brigade is part of it, is stationed, they won't agree, for example, to civilian corridors that the Russians have tried to establish for civilians to get out, and they've held the people of Mariupol as hostages at gunpoint who were trying to leave. Similar to the way that the terrorists in many Syrian cities tried to keep the civilians as human shield as the Syrian Arab army was advancing. It's the same tactic exactly.
Yeah, Max Blumenthal outlined that with great clarity, the Syria analogy.
Right. So I really feel for the people in Ukraine, the women and children especially, who are hiding in cellars and subways and stuff like that. But to be perfectly frank, what the solution to this is de-escalation and negotiation. And what has to happen is that instead of the West egging on Zelensky and his Nazi-riddled government with shipments of arms, lethal arms, into Poland to be shipped over the borders, what really should happen, and of course, I can't ignore the fact that there's such a propaganda campaign. It's unbelievable. I haven't seen anything like it since, it compares to the propaganda campaigns used against Saddam Hussein. He was a new Hitler. Now Putin's taken over that role.
Remember the freedom fries that when George Bush, when France wouldn't join the coalition of the willing, and freedom fries were now everything was there. There was a tax against France and its markets. Now we see here in British Columbia, vodka being taken off of the liquor store shelves almost immediately, like on day one, and everybody and their dog is out supporting Ukraine. And of course we all feel, as you say, for the civilians being caught under this, but this is an amazing media campaign. And I'm sorry to step in on you, Ken, like that, but we're fast running out of time. How do you recommend people get more involved, get educated, and bolster themselves against this hurricane of propaganda and misinformation that they're getting from our state media and others?
Well, two things then. I would suggest people go to our website and our Facebook page and our Twitter accounts, where we're publishing articles by people like Danny Haifong and Ben Norton of Multipolarista and Diana Johnston and Scott Ritter. All these people understand how the U.S. and NATO manipulated Russia into this position and why the Russian reaction is understandable. And of course, people should have a look at our website and see this, our statement. And we are planning to have a Zoom webinar coming up in the next week or 10 days, when we will be featuring speakers of our own and other groups, such as Fire This Time and other groups around the country who have taken the same position as us, that Russia is not the enemy, and that what really needs to happen is NATO should be dissolved. It should have been dissolved in 1990 when the Soviet Union dissolved itself, because NATO was set up by none other than Lester B. Pearson when he was foreign minister of Canada to stop the spread of communism, or to prevent the spread or defend against the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet Union disappeared in 1991, but NATO did not.
Well, some don't believe that the Soviet Union disappeared, and that the rebirth of the Soviet Empire is in the person of Vladimir Putin. And Canada, to its shame, can have upped the stakes and are sending more sophisticated and more deadly weapons into the battle zone, and threatening to send soldiers there as well. I can't say in any other terms that if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, Canada is at war. And this looks like it could be a spreading situation. And definitely it's going to affect all of us one way or the other. Even if it does stop today, the effects are going to be long lasting. Ken, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time. Thanks a lot for coming on again. Again, it's Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.ca. You can get more information on what the coalition is up to and their friends. There's another webinar I see at the bottom of your press release, Fog of War Over Ukraine, the International Manifesto Group, as having a panel discussion on this tomorrow. I see some of my past guests are on there. Radhika Desai moderating it. Look that up. Fog of War Over Ukraine. Thanks a lot, Ken, for coming on again. I want you all to stick around. I'm going to take a brief break, but then I'll be back with Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored. And we're going to talk a little bit about this too and the whole media atmosphere surrounding it. Thanks again, Ken.
1, 2, 3, 4. Chris Chandler and Paul Benoit in the great city of Victoria. When I'm here, I listen to All Good News all the time. That's CFUB, my favorite radio station, because it's independent and alternative media. I consider them the big media. They give you the real story. And when I'm not here, I listen to it online at cfuv.uvic.ca. Thank you.
tragic. It all just falls apart. But when I look into your eyes, it pieces up my heart. If I only had an answer to put it all to bed, I wish sometimes I could take back every word I've said. I walk back in the night alone, got caught up in my song, forgot where I was sleeping, none of the lights were on. Heard my mother thinking me right back into my birth. I laughed so loud inside myself, it all began to hurt. So I turned on a picture show, I disappeared the line. As memories came flooding in, the tears blew out my eyes.
The following program presents ideas and perspectives of the program's host, not that of CFUV or its staff.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 6th, 2022. Well, the last 2 years has proven a challenge to all of us. As individuals, the degree of that challenge has varied. For all the usual reasons, life is more difficult for some than others, and for some new reasons too. But more importantly, the pandemic, piled on top of the already present stressors of poverty, pollution, war, and ecological collapse, has made evident the fragility of our societies and even that of human civilization. In these early years of the 21st century, the failure to maintain public trust has cascaded from all corners, from corporations and the government to the church and even philanthropic institutions. All have lost favor in the public mind. None of these, however, are as mistrusted as media. From all the news that's fit to print to fake news unfit for human consumption, there is a crisis of communication that today threatens us as surely as any war or impending natural catastrophe. Andy Lee Roth is the Associate Director of Project Censored and coordinates the project's Campus Affiliates program. His writings and research are published across the internet and in a variety of print publications. Andy's co-edited a dozen editions of Project Censored's yearbooks, including the 2022 version, State of the Free Press 2022. It's now out and available from Seven Stories Press. Well, welcome to the program, Andy.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to join you, Chris.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Andy, for those unaware, and there, I'm sure there's many out there yet, even after all these years, what is Project Censored?
Project Censored is a newswatch organization that has two real primary aims. The first is to inform and educate and inspire the public about the important role of a truly free press for democracy. And alongside that, we do hands-on education, especially for students and college-age students in particular, hands-on education in critical media literacy. So the way we go about doing those things, the project produces an annual yearbook where we review the previous year's top censored stories, we call them, and media analysis. So stories and issues that have been underreported in the corporate media, but that we know about thanks to the courageous work of independent journalists and news outlets. We have a weekly radio program that airs on about 50 terrestrial radio stations across the U.S. and obviously streams online. And then we have, as associate director of the project, I'm in charge of the projects, not in charge of, that's the wrong way to put it. I help coordinate the project's Campus Affiliates program, which links several hundred students and faculty members at college campuses across North America including up there north of the border. And the Campus Affiliates Program links students and faculty at these campuses in identifying and vetting important but underreported news stories. So it's a really, for me, inspiring thing to be part of.
Well, people might latch onto that now and thinking, yeah, obviously this is a big need. They hear about fake news and all the rest of it and what's going on online. But this Project Censored has been going on for a lot longer than the current media environment. What's the provenance of the project?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the project started in 1976 at Sonoma State University, which is part of the California State University system, where at Sonoma State, Carl Jensen was teaching sociology and communications courses. And he and students in his courses began to dig, well, what stories are being missed by the corporate press, the mainstream establishment press? They began to do that after one of Carl's students asked him, how was it possible that on the evening that Richard Nixon was declared president of the United States, that he'd been reelected as president of the United States, that none of the major TV networks covering Nixon's reelection for a single time mentioned the Watergate scandal, which at that time had been broken as a story. It was a known thing. And that kind of gap in the establishment media's coverage of Nixon's reelection spurred Carl and his students to begin digging these stories. And the project has been doing the same ever since. And as I mentioned a moment ago, you know, for the last 10, 12 years, the project is expanded far beyond the campus of Sonoma State University, although we still have strong connections there. And now we're digging these stories thanks to researchers, student researchers, and faculty evaluators all across the country. So really the aim is, Carl had this great idea. He talked early on about the concept of news inflation. And he'd unpack it by saying, with news, we seem to have more and more news, but it seems to be worth less and less. And Jensen was on to this. Jensen was on to this before we had 24/7 news cycles, the kind of the CNN, you know, round the clock news reporting, before we had the internet, before we had social media. So you can think of the project in some ways as an effort to counter news inflation, that what we're doing, what everyone involved in the project is doing is saying, out of the kind of fire hose of information, disinformation, and misinformation being spewed at you every day through all these media outlets, here are a small selection of news stories that we've identified and vetted and verified as important and worthy of attention and factually based and transparently sourced. And the idea is to counter that kind of sense of there's so much out there, I'm overwhelmed, I don't want to pay attention, it's too depressing.
Well, as far as inflation goes, what's old is news again. But it's hard to imagine in today's environment, as you describe it, way back then with the three network news and the news, you know, there's many more newspapers and more vibrant ones at that in that period. But hard to imagine people being overwhelmed by the daily news the way that we are now, where it is just a blizzard of information, a bafflement of it. I'm holding the book in my hands here, The State of the Free Press 2022. And as you describe it, it's 25 of the, and censored doesn't mean that these things are whited out necessarily or blacked out, but that they are underrepresented.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Yeah. Project Censored, we use what we think of as a 21st definition of censorship that says that anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have, you know, a democratic political organization and a free press amounts to a form of censorship. So in the 21st century, we still have things like what you could, you know, the kind of traditional historical notion of censorship is some form of gatekeeping, where a powerful entity, whether it's a government official or the editor at the newspaper, or, you know, perhaps a religious organization, acts as a gatekeeper and says, you can't print that, you can't broadcast that. right? That's one form. That's what we know, you know, kind of in legal terms as prior restraint. But there are many forms of censorship operating today, including in the United States, that aren't captured by that notion of prior restraint or that metaphor of a gatekeeping model that we have to take into account. So, for instance, I've written some about the idea of a new form of gatekeeping that is not necessarily human, or at least directly human, the idea that more and more today we get our news through social media channels and social media platforms, so Twitter, Facebook, and the like. And those are algorithmically gatekept forums, right? There is artificial intelligence determining what you see in your Facebook feed. And those we know are increasingly shaped in ways that promote certain kinds of news stories, and news here maybe ought to be in scare quotes, promote certain kind of news stories and marginalize or blockade other kinds of stories. And so the idea that when we use various internet interfaces that we have, like a search engine such as Google, that that's a neutral tool, or that the Facebook algorithm that feeds you some information, or YouTube's algorithm that highlights some videos as recommendations and downplays or demonetizes other channels, right? That's also a form of, that has the potential, I should say, to be a form of censorship that we ought to be aware of and concerned about.
Self-censorship too, of course, is always a thing. But I mean, now the artificial intelligence is also writing the articles. I've seen pieces that I'm not sure were, if they were written by computers or by people, about articles being written by computers. So we really are in a brave new world. Your introduction, co-written with your co-editor, Mickey Huff, A Return to News Normalcy. And this begins at least focusing on these last 2 years with the COVID-19 pandemic. What effect has the pandemic had on news coverage in the United States?
Well, one way to think about that is in the United States, the Poynter Institute has documented since March 2020 the kind of onset of at least our awareness, our kind of societal awareness of COVID-19. Poynter Institute documents since March 2020 more than 100 closures of local newsrooms. That means there's 100 communities around the country where there is no longer a local source of local news. This feeds into a problem that pre-existed the pandemic, what we know and talk about as news deserts, communities where there is no local news because there are no local news outlets. And that trend was already being driven by the consolidation of media ownership that we know has been ongoing since at least the deregulation, the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And COVID has simply accelerated and amplified that trend. Now, I should hasten to add, the problem with news deserts is obviously then you have a dearth of local news. And what happens in those cases, and there's serious data-driven studies to show, to demonstrate what I'm about to describe in kind of simplistic terms, in the absence of authentic local news, real local news reporting, opportunistic players move in and take advantage of the need and the hunger and the craving for local news. And what they substitute is what in effect amounts to political propaganda. And so one of our top stories, not in this year's book, The State of the Free Press 2022, but one of our top stories from last year, from previous year's book, the 2021 State of the Free Press yearbook, was how a shadow network of conservative outlets were emerging and expanding to exploit both the need for and the faith in local news reporting. So they appear to be the shadow network appears to be local and authentic reporting, but actually, as we were documenting in our coverage of this trend, these outlets are actually kind of mouthpieces for politically motivated organizations that don't have any commitment to journalistic ethics. They're Trojan horses, in effect. So at a time when, you know, right now, today, we're deeply concerned, for instance, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, about the influence of Russian propaganda and Russian stations like RT America are being, you know, deplatformed and demonetized by U.S. organizations. This kind of internal version of that has gone basically unnoticed and unreported, except for in independent outlets.
Well, not only political, but business and corporate oriented news, and I'll use scare quotes too, these news organizations that are really just corporate fronts. But you never notice that more than when something happens locally, as did here in our town in Victoria a couple months ago. We had an extraordinary snowfall, for example. And when you try to get news, local news about what's going on when there's some kind of emergency or something else, then you realize, oh, you're knocking on a door that there's nobody behind. There's just nothing to be had from it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a serious problem because, listen, obviously it almost goes without saying, but let me say it anyhow. The whole reason that we need high-quality news is so that we can be informed and engaged community members and citizens, if not citizens of one nation or another, global citizens, right? Without that free flow of information and multiple, sometimes even conflicting perspectives, we can't formulate coherent, intelligent positions of our own. And then we either are, you know, the result of that is we either become passive and disconnected and inactive, or we become easily led by the nose, by those who are more informed and don't necessarily have our interests at heart. This is why something like freedom of the press is upheld in numerous Supreme Court decisions in the U.S. and ultimately kind of enshrined, at least as far as government interference goes, in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Lee Roth. Andy is an associate director of Project Censored, and he coordinates their campus affiliates program. His writings and research are published across the internet and in a variety of print publications, too. He's co-edited a dozen editions of Project Censored's famous yearbooks, including this year's 2022 version, State of the Free Press 2022. That, I will remind, is out and available from Seven Stories Press right now, and you can go to projectcensored.org and find out how you can order it and more. Well, Andy, again with the COVID, how has it affected the quality of news? And I'll give you an example. Here in Canada, the CRTC, which is our federal regulator, I guess analogous to your FCC down there, in some regards, at least, they had secretive meetings with independent radio stations and First Nations radio stations, college stations, and so forth. And they laid down the parameters of reporting on the pandemic, what could and could not be said. Did something similar happen in the United States?
Not to my knowledge, in that kind of systemic, organized, top-down way, but what I am aware of, and what I do think is a real factor, is how not government entities, but these big social media platforms have all, in effect, come up with policies more or less well-informed, often less well-informed, in my opinion, of how to handle COVID information and COVID news. So it's not unique to the United States, but content on YouTube, on Instagram, on Facebook can all be flagged by those entities as, you know, COVID-related material that then gets a little, a little banner or a warning of some sort. And this is a thorny issue, Chris. I really think we're in a very difficult terrain here. On one hand, we want to do all we can, and it has to do everything with the flow of information /misinformation, disinformation, right? How does information flow? What accelerates the flow of information? What slows down the flow of information? When it's positive and fact-based and verifiable and transparently sourced, we would like information to flow freely, right? When it's misinformation or disinformation, we would like to be able to block its progress, right? To slow down its spread. And I think, whether we're talking about governmental regulations or the policies of these big social media, global giants, I think the thorny area is how do we decide who or what is trustworthy? And I don't think there's a single kind of top-down, one-size-fits-all, works-in-every-case answer to that question. This is why at Project Censored, we emphasize the importance of critical media literacy, right? That it's almost impossible, I think, today to be an active, engaged, you know, community member and global citizen if you don't have some modicum of critical media literacy, which includes the ability to evaluate skeptically, critically, you know, without regard to one's own interests and biases, whether something ought to be trusted or not.
Well, and not only the how do we do it, but the who that does it before even COVID. This was an effort by certain organizations, some of them pretty shady, to control the flow of information across the internet. I'm thinking specifically of the Integrity Initiative that put itself forward as an independent arbiter of truth online. And we discovered later, and thanks largely to the work of the grayzone.com, Max Blumenthal's effort, that these guys, the Integrity Initiative, were aligned with the Atlantic Council and various government agencies, some of them quite nefarious, that they weren't exactly who they were pretending to be at all. And yet they were the ones that would be the arbiters of so-called true information. And there have been other projects since then. And now with the COVID pandemic as a pretext, it seems, at least in Canada, that there has been a real heavy move to control what can and can't be said. And I'll remind you, our American listeners, that we in Canada don't have a First Amendment, so we aren't protected in the way that you are down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so who checks the fact checkers is something that Mickey Huff, the director of Project Censored, and I have written about. And to take just one example of an organization that has positioned itself prominently, NewsGuard, right, is one of these organizations that you're mentioning, Chris, that presents itself as a trustworthy judge of fake news and misinformation. NewsGuard is thoroughly intertwined with at least one major corporate entity, Microsoft. And NewsGuard's advisory board includes a number of former government officials, including people like the first director of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, Michael Hayden, who ran the CIA when George W. Bush was president, right? These people, and so NewsGuard has gotten a pretty sweet ride in the corporate press in the United States as, oh, this is the kind of thing we need to protect ourselves against Russian, you know, psyops and you know, fake news and this, that, and the other. But it's pretty easy to see why establishment news media have kind of sided up with organizations like NewsGuard. The who's who of the you know, the advisory board looks just like the establishment news media's standard narrow criteria of who counts as a newsworthy actor or source. So there's, I think, a lot of room to be skeptical and to assess. And this is sort of what I mean when I say critical media literacy. It's digging into and saying, well, who is NewsGuard? Where's the money coming from for NewsGuard? Who are the people who are informing and NewsGuard's choices and making those choices? And when you see that it's people like, you know, the former head of the Department of Homeland Security or the chief of the CIA, you know, I don't think you have to be a crazy radical progressive to say, wait a minute, are those the people are those the wolves we want guarding the hen house?
Yeah, well, you don't have to be Ed Murrow to figure
right
out that there's something going wrong here. You mentioned that now, right now, following on to the pandemic coverage and the new strictures put on free speech in this country, Canada, at least, there is, and you mentioned the Russian invasion in Ukraine. It's been unprecedented, the reaction up here. We're seeing government liquor stores, for example, immediately taking Russian products off of the shelves. The reaction seems in some degrees orchestrated, in others not so much so, but it seems to be monolithic, and it seems to be, at least to me, organized to some degree. Am I being paranoid, you think, to think that the media is enacting a pre-planned script?
I don't know if it's pre-planned or not, but the consequences of it are systemic. I would point people listening to us, our conversation now, and interested in these issues, I would point people to an article published by FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a few days ago. The title of the article is Foreign Agents Designation Causes Media Cold War, an article, a report by Ari Paul, P-A-U-L. You can find this article online. I'll just cover a few highlights. The basic upshot of this FAIR report is that, any number of nations now have state-owned and controlled media outlets. It's easy with the internet for people around the world to access those. In the United States, some of the journalists who work for these state organizations have to register as foreign agents with the U.S. Department of Justice, but not all. And this is a distinction the FAIR article says has more to do with geopolitics than with journalism. And so, for instance, RT America, which is the sister station of Russia's state-sponsored RT, since 2017, journalists working, including U.S. citizens who work as journalists with RT America, have had to register with the Justice Department as foreign agents. And just a couple days ago now, DirecTV, which is the largest distributor of RT broadcasting in the United States, DirecTV and Roku basically pulled the plug on RT America, leading RT America to shut down basically all its U.S. operations. So there would be people who would say, well, there's no government censorship of the press in the United States. We have a First Amendment, after all. But this looks, as this article by Fairness and Accuracy and Reporting documents in more detail than I'm going to try to go into now, this looks like an ideologically driven decision to shut down, effectively to shut down certain stations. And what the role, say, of the Justice Department is in, in coordinating with DirecTV, Roku, RT America has been demonetized on YouTube. So the channel is still up, but it can't make any advertising revenue through YouTube. This happens in the same week. So RT America can no longer effectively broadcast in the United States. This happens the same week that an elected U.S. official can go on Twitter and openly call for the assassination of Putin, yeah. Right? Yeah. Lindsey Graham did that on Twitter this week. And there's been reaction to that, right? That wasn't let pass as just, oh, Lindsey Graham being Lindsey Graham, right? But the disconnect there, or the juxtaposition of those, for me is really a kind of a shocking thing.
Well, and shocking to me, RT is often dismissed as being nothing more than state media. Well, we have a state media here in Canada. It's called the CBC. And in regards to the conflict going on right now in Ukraine, over the last few days, the CBC has been emphasizing the nuclear danger of radiation coming from a nuclear plant that was in the middle of a conflict, apparently. It's hard to know the truth of any of this right now. They walked that back this morning, but they never mentioned that they had been pushing this idea that there was nuclear radiation leaking from this facility, when in fact that wasn't the case. But not only was it, I mean, they did correct the news, but they didn't correct themselves. Now, Andy, there's a ton more that we could talk about, but sadly, this venue isn't appropriate for it, and we're out of time. But again, Andy Lee Roth is the co-editor with Mickey Huff of this year's Project Censored, State of the Free Press. It's a loads, and I've hardly had time to get into it, Mickey, other than some of your contributions, yours and Mickey's contributions to it. But it looks like an absolute ripping read. How do people get their hands on it?
They can go to projectcensored.org and buy the book directly from us. And you can also ask for it in your local independent bookshop.
Well, Andy, thanks a lot for coming on today and talking to us a little bit about this. And hopefully we can talk again and maybe at more length in the future.
That would be a pleasure, Chris. Thanks so much for featuring Project Censored's work on Guerrilla Radio.
Well, my pleasure. And I want to thank you for coming on and thank Ken Stone as well.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Looking for a news source that believes you're big enough for the truth? Why not try CFUV Radio? We know you can take it, but we need your help to keep giving it to you. Donate now at supportcfuv.ca. Yeah, it's funding drive again.
We want the truth!
You want the truth? You can't handle the truth! No truth handler, you! I deride your truth handling abilities.
Will you get to the point?
Dancing days are here again. Summer evenings
grow. When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM and CFUV.ca. A century of news every Thursday and Saturday.